You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 142 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to a Blood Wolf. Wait, what? Blood Red? Nope. Oh, Blood.
You're way off on this. You mean to say the Vin Baker edition?
Oh, I do not. I don't know that I mean to say that. Although we're coming. A Super Blood Wolf Moon edition of the Pelton Cast. No?
There's going to be a total eclipse of my heart in these football games that we watched earlier today.
Boy.
There was.
We don't have to talk about that.
Oh, my God.
We should start by talking about this week's beer, which is a beer we've previously drank on the Pelton the Cast last
drank
April.
You're just off today. How many of these have you drank already?
I'm drinking some sake. The Sierra Nevada Tropical Torpedo IPA.
And this is a spring seasonal, and I tell you, there have been a couple of moments where I'm feeling some spring feelings.
Yeah, were you feeling the spring feelings when it was a high of 43 today?
That was the high today?
I believe so.
Wow, it was chilly out. Okay, today was one 47. Of the days where I was feeling spring feelings, but I've been feeling them lately. College basketball's in the air. We're doing a ramen bracket. Spring coming!
I don't know if ramen season is necessarily the spring, but okay. This is a tropical take on the American IPA inspired by the island life. We created an IPA completely disconnected from the mainland. We used our one-of-a-kind hop torpedo to deliver an intense rush of hop flavor and the lush aromas of mango, papaya, and passion fruit with every sip. Enjoy our tropical twist on the American IPA.
I don't know if Sierra Nevada can do anything that's quote-unquote completely disconnected from the mainland.
It would seem weird if they did that. Do you have anything we should get into before we go to ramen?
Well, speaking of completely disconnected from the mainland, let's get right into our ramen bracket week one. The number one seed, Ramen Donbo versus Betsu Tenjin. Let's go.
To help us make our first elimination, we're excited to welcome in his third Pelton brother, James Darnbrook.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Great chance for me to be a third Pelton brother.
James, welcome. I think you're the first ever British third Pelton brother.
Oh, well, that's just an honor. Look at that.
Which is fitting, given that the name Pelton is, in fact, English. So it works out quite well, finally.
Perfect.
And then we're doing a ramen bracket.
You want to tell us a little about your ramen credentials?
Yeah, so I guess my ramen credentials come from the fact that I lived in Japan for 3 years and essentially had ramen every time I was hungover. So quite a lot of times.
How is ramen perceived in Japan?
I think it's kind of seen as a relatively like fast food and is just a common thing that a lot of people eat for lunch or as a quick dinner. I mean, I can't speak for everybody in Japan, but yeah, I think it's just something that's easy to get.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, so I lived in Kyushu, which is famous for that tonkotsu ramen, that pork bone ramen, but they have different types all over Japan. And so different areas are sort of famous for different types. The north of Japan is kind of famous for like miso ramen, whereas the south of Japan is famous for that tonkotsu ramen. And then they also have like soy ramen and then like a salt-based ramen as well. So there's a few different types and it generally kind of is like regionally located. Different places are sort of more famous for different types.
So which is the shoyu and which is the shio?
Shoyu is soy sauce. Yeah. Shio is salt.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And so you were in the south of Japan with the tonkotsu, the pork ramen?
Yeah, that's right. So Kyushu and Fukuoka especially, which is where I lived for 2 of the 3 years. That's where tonkotsu ramen is from. That's the most famous place for it.
And can you describe kind of the pork broth ramen for a second here?
Yeah, so I think it's made from pork bone. And then they kind of generally, lots of places will boil it down for multiple days, that pork bone. And then you get that flavor from it. Different places have a different flavor. Sometimes you get places that have a very rich, deep flavor and some places that have a more milky flavor. But yeah, it really depends on who's making it and what kind of ramen they're doing.
And we saw maybe those two extremes in this first round matchup. Well, not going to get to that quite yet, but how much ramen have you had since you've been in the U.S., and how does it compare to the ramen you had in Japan in general?
I mean, I've had it a few different times here. Generally, it's just a bigger variant. You know, like there are some really great places in the U.S. that I've been to. You know, like one of the places that I don't want to spoil it for later, but one of the places was really good. And then, you know, often you get some really bad ramens as well. So I think it's just a bigger variance from my perspective.
Huh. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think the two places that we went to had relatively small menus. Mm-hmm. And I know that there was at least one person out there when we unveiled the ramen bracket that was mentioning the Kazuki Ramen, which is kind of one of the more notable places in Seattle. And I know that they have all of these options. You've got shio, shoyu, tonkatsu, miso. You could get anything there. But it felt like the two places we went to this week kind of specialized a little bit more in kind of a couple of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, from my experience in Japan, it's exactly the same. Like, you would have places that would do miso ramen, and then you'd have a different place completely that would do tonkatsu, and they wouldn't necessarily switch, if you see what I mean. Like, that they just do that one type, and they try to do it as well as they can. That's sort of how I've experienced it.
Makes sense, yeah. And here it's more trying to be everything to all people, because people with all sorts of different experiences and interests in ramen are coming to a lot of these places.
Yeah, for sure.
Should we get into it then?
Yeah, let's do it.
So our first matchup was the 1-8 matchup between the top seed Ramen Danbo, which is a Japanese chain which has two locations in Vancouver and then two locations in the U.S., Seattle and Brooklyn. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I think so. I looked at the map. It looked like that.
pretty amazing that, I mean, granted, it makes sense with Seattle being kind of one of the closest metropolitan cities to Japan, but also, hello, Seattle.
Yeah, doing quite well there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Up against the number 8 seed, a local Seattle single restaurant, Betsu Tenjin. James, you want to start us off with your kind of impressions of these two locations?
Yeah, so I actually went for the same thing in both. I had like the tonkatsu ramen with a side of gyoza. And for me, I much preferred the danbo. That's like cutting to the quick of it. Yeah, for me, it was definitely the danbo. It was a more flavorful, a deeper ramen. Like that broth is just, it tastes so much more porky, I guess. And yeah, for me, that's number one.
Yeah, I was kind of trying to guess when you said that you much preferred one of them, which it was going to be.
It was pretty clear to me which one. If you spent time in Japan, this is our number one seed ramen here, right?
It is our number one seed. So, okay, let's focus in on Danbo for a little bit. What they sort of specialize in, they have a number of different options. I actually disagree with your statement that they specialize in something.
But it's basically tonkatsu or miso, right?
They definitely offered a shio option, I'm pretty sure. And then they offer a curry ramen is like their seasonal. And
oh, that's true, yeah.
I want to try that in the event we perhaps go back because of the fact that they win this round. Who knows what's going to happen?
You've got a suspense. Punch card.
Yeah, which you gave me yours to merge them. And I feel like you're underestimating how often we may go over the next few weeks here. But they give you all sorts of different options in terms of how you want to customize your ramen, how strong you want the broth to be, the thin or thick noodles, how well done you want the noodles to be, whether you want them to be softer or harder, all these, and there's other options in there. You kind of get your choice. So what did you go with in terms of these options? Anything non-standard?
I tend to go for something a little bit richer. So I went with a richer taste, and then I think the addition is lard on the second one, so I went right for a slightly richer one there as well. And then for me, I prefer the thick noodle, but that's just kind of personal choice, so I just remember that. What about you?
So I experimented a fair bit. I went with the strong broth as well, and then what I did, because of the fact that they offer, again, a Japanese custom, the option of getting in additional noodles after you've eaten your original noodles. I started out with the thin noodles and then later got the thicker ones to add back in there. And both times got those extra soft because I do prefer a softer noodle. Tristan, you went kind of straight down the board, right?
Yeah, I wanted to just try the standard. I got the thick noodle was the only thing that I sort of customized. But I just wanted to get kind of the standard ramen for this test the first time through.
I thought that the strong broth was really interesting. I mean, it almost came out so dark that it was like eating gravy in a way. Not quite that viscous, perhaps, but similar in terms of color. And as much as I like a hearty broth, I felt this was kind of maybe a little bit too strong for me. But it sounds like you liked it that way.
Wow. Yeah. For me, that's kind of the goal. Like, that's why it's a great hangover food as well.
True. That is good for the ideal for that purpose. So I have decided, even though it's not necessarily going to be straight by this, that I'm going to do my overall scoring to go in the individual categories of broth, noodles, and then the chashu, pork belly, that's a traditional part of the ramen experience. So I gave Donbo an 8 of 10 on the broth, an 8 of 10 on the noodles, which I particularly like the ability to order them a little softer. And then I actually was not that impressed by the pork belly. I gave that only a 3 of 10. Any disagreements?
3 of 10 on the pork belly?
Yeah.
I mean, I think for me, for sure, it's the worst part. It's the weakest part is the pork belly.
Right.
But, you know, the broth makes up for it in my mind.
I mean, one of the things I think that is clarified for me already in the first week of this experiment is that the pork belly is not a very important part of this, you know, the whole ramen equation to me. It can put a good bowl of ramen over the top if you have a good piece of pork belly, but I don't think it's necessarily taking that much away, detracting that much if you don't have a good pork belly.
Yeah, I can see that for sure.
The broth is probably the most important part of the ramen situation because you're basically tasting it in every single bite.
Yeah, absolutely.
The pork belly is at least a 6.
Hmm.
To me, between the two places, there were a couple things that stood out. I felt like the noodles, I would probably actually give Betsu Tenjin a little bit of an advantage.
Oh, wow. I completely disagree. I did not like the Betsu Tenjin noodles.
So the standard noodles at Donbo are kind of a harder noodle.
Uh-huh.
So like maybe if I'd ordered it softer, I might feel the same way as you because I didn't specifically do that. And next time I might. But I would prefer those. The broth, on the other hand, is there's almost... Like, I mean, they're completely different broths.
Yeah.
These two locations. The Betsu Tenjin broth, to me, I compare it closest to, like, cream of mushroom soup.
I guess.
Yeah.
It's very creamy. It's like a rich flavor, but there's no kick to it. There's no extra gear to it.
Yeah, I felt like it really became kind of bland the more of it I had, which is why I felt it was very important to add the chili flakes that they offer. Unfortunately, the table we were sitting at when we went back, the two of us, your one experience there, we did not have a thing of chili flakes. You weren't able to add that in.
Yeah. I mean, it's really busy when I went as well, so...
Yeah, both of these places I think are generally pretty busy, but Danbo has, you know, it's a larger room. They're more capable of handling that. And Betsu Tenjin, you feel like you're crammed in there very much.
Yeah, I think so.
Which, was that in your experience more typical of ramen shops in Japan?
I mean, from my experience, they're actually both a little bit kind of typical. It really depends. Like, there are some, obviously, you have the kind of chain ramen shop, and it is a lot like Danbo. And then you have a sort of more mom and pop type store, and it was quite a lot like Betsu Tenjin. So I think they're both a little bit like that.
The other thing I think we should is worth discussing with Danbo a little bit. This is not going to be a large part of my scores. We've expressed our issues with this on Yelp in the past. But the service was notable in how outstanding and efficient it was at Danbo.
Yeah, I can see that.
I mean, I've never been to Japan. I've not eaten there, but it felt very Japanese to me. And I don't know, maybe you could speak to whether that's actually kind of typical.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I actually felt like the Betsu Tenjin was a little bit more typical of Japan.
Interesting.
You know, just with somebody that comes around and makes it happen. And then someone, you know, not that many people, but they're kind of making it happen for a lot of different customers.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, we waited a long time with the Betsu Tenjin. It is tiny.
Yeah. But then you get a lot of like sort of ramen places in Japan that are kind of like 6 seats and that's it. That's all they're going to do.
All right. So let's talk about the ramen at Betsu Tenjin. We've sort of gotten into this. I scored the broth a 7 of 10. I really did enjoy how creamy it was, but again, it got a little bland over time. The noodles I gave only a 2 of 10. They just didn't measure up to me to the other noodles I've had. And then the chashu I gave 6 out of 10 on the pork belly, which is really well charred, I think, notably at Betsu Tenjin.
Yeah. What about you, Tristan?
To me, the thing that let me down the most there was the pork belly, where you're almost getting nothing out of that pork belly. It was very mild. The whole thing was just very mild. I liked it, though. Look, to me, I think just based on our conversation, we know what the winner was here.
Yes.
But this was not a 16-to-1 situation. Like, Betsu Tenjin is not that far off from what Donbo is doing. The couple of places where I feel like Donbo was really quite a bit better were just the little bit of kick in the
broth.
In the broth, where you can kind of taste it. I almost wanted a little bit more spiciness from them, but just that little extra bit of spiciness and flavor. And to me, it was the pork belly, where the pork belly I felt like was quite a bit stronger at Donbo than it was at the Betsu Tenjin.
That's interesting, because I kind of agree with Kevin. Like, I preferred the pork belly at Betsu Tenjin, for sure, and then thought that the actual broth was kind of, you know, it was okay. I didn't really care for it, and the noodles the same. And then I quite like the gyoza on the side.
Yeah, that was pretty solid. So I had the Hakata or Tonkatsu ramen the first time I went, which is, you know, their classic option. The second time when I went back with Tristan, I had the miso prawn ramen, and I felt that was a much better ramen to me, much more competitive with Danbo, and an entirely better overall experience, partially because of the fact that it was a more flavorful broth than the Tonkatsu broth that they have.
That's interesting.
I also like that comes standard with corn in it, and I don't know if I've had ramen with corn in it, but it worked.
I think it's what you do with those extras as well. Like on both menus, you can add extra egg, you can add extra seaweed, you can add extra whatever. I think it's interesting what people choose. I always add the seaweed. I'm a big fan.
You can have mine next time.
I moved the seaweed. I like moved it from the side because it came on the Betsu Tenjin ramen.
Yeah.
And I moved it in. I'm just like, I'm not eating this. I'm fine with the flavor lingering.
I think that was something that's really true about Donbo in particular, is like, it feels like with all the options there, the more often you go, the more you're going to like it, because you're going to kind of hone in on what you really want.
Yeah, I actually felt like I was cheating a little bit, because I knew I would want a richer taste. And so you didn't get that option at Betsu Tenjin, and maybe that's the difference.
But I think that's part of the appeal, is that you do have that option to customize with whatever you're going to like.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, we got a comment on Instagram from friend of the pod, Ilya, and he was like, what should I order? He actually lives in Brooklyn and is near the location there. And my response was like, look, they'll give you whatever you want. Just go with whatever you like. I don't think there is any specific thing to order.
There's also basically like 3 ramen stores.
I know. It's not that wide open a menu. James, what other ramen locations have you been to in Seattle? And do you have Danbo exceed the other ones you've been to? Or is it on the same level?
Yeah, so a few of them are on your list. So I've been to Santuka, and I've been to Oink, and I've been to Kizuki as well. Mm-hmm. And I think actually for me, Danbo has the best tonkatsu ramen of the ones. I don't think some of those other ones are even trying to do that type of ramen. They're trying to do something completely different. And it's, you know, trying to compare apples and oranges. But I thought Danbo was maybe the best tonkatsu ramen I've had outside of Japan.
Interesting. That's high praise.
I mean, which kind of makes sense being a Japanese chain.
Yeah. But there are a number of Japanese chains. And in fact, I think one of them, Hokkaido Ramen Santuka, which is the other one you mentioned, that didn't end up making your top 8 because it wasn't highly rated enough.
Oh.
You sound skeptical of that. I mean, one of the things I want to try to do is maybe go to some of the places outside the top 8 just for comparison, because, you know, I want a full accounting, even though we didn't want this bracket to go on for months and months because we've got to get to sandwiches at some point here. But to spoil a little bit, we did also, because of the long wait at Betsu Tenjin, before going there, also went to Oink and tried both of those tonight. So we got a jump start on next week's 2-versus-7 matchup. So that'll be coming soon.
Wow.
All right. Well, we really appreciate you joining us and sharing your expertise.
We should do an official vote here.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. For the first round in the Peltoncast Ramen Bracket Winter 2019, James, 1-versus-8. Who is your winner?
For me, it's got to be Danbo.
Danbo?
It's Danbo.
It's a clean sweep, unsurprisingly. The first entrant in the semifinals of our search for Seattle's best ramen is Ramen Danbo.
But I will say for Betsu Tenjin, you know, as they exit, it's not bad ramen.
No.
If you were a person who wanted kind of a creamier type of ramen, or if for some reason there was a shorter line there or whatever, it's still a great place to go to. This is not a blowout.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
All right, James, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your ramen expertise. We have appreciated having you as a third Belton brother.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that was great stuff.
Thank you again to James Romberg for joining us as third Pelton brother and eating ramen this week, bearing the lines. Look, ramen's, you know, these aren't burger places. You have to work a little bit to get this ramen.
Yeah, but you know what the good news is?
What's that?
You get to eat ramen.
There we go.
Which I have now eaten 3.5 bowls of in the past 4 days.
What do we have coming up next week? You mentioned Oink for people who are eating along with the Peltoncast search for Seattle's best ramen.
Great point. We are staying in the Capitol Hill area where both of our top two seeds and both of our bottom two seeds in this eight ramen bracket hail from. So Oink is the two seed, and the seven seed, as James mentioned at one point, is Suica.
All right. So we're going to be doing 2-versus-7 next week also. You know, we talked about last week, Seattle Times was doing a bit of a search for Seattle's best ramen. This week, Amazon is doing a search for Seattle's best ramen.
Amazon is not doing a search for Seattle's best ramen.
Two words for you, Amazon.com. Cease and desist.
I mean, first off, Amazon probably has some really amazing lawyers, although they may be otherwise occupied.
Oh, they've
right
got
now.
Nothing on the famous cousin Katie.
It's Amazon
Web. Those lawyers are doing it for money. Katie is doing it for the love of ramen.
Amazon Web Services has for many weeks been running an ad saying that one of the things that their web services, their cloud provides is the ability to build a service helping people find the best ramen.
Helping people find
they're actually referring best ramen. They're referring to Yelp. They're not actually themselves searching for Seattle's best ramen. This is a nationwide search. Although, if you believe third Belton brother Ben B, Yelp's still doing it wrong. You got to go to TripAdvisor instead.
We should be reviewing just to get some reviews up on TripAdvisor.
Yeah, I wanted
Were
for
there any on Betsu Tenjin?
There was one. No, there I was wanted one. For troll.
They could have one negative review and be roasted forever on TripAdvisor.
I wanted to link to that for troll purposes after last week's Yelp debate, Yelp TripAdvisor debate, but sadly, it did not work. But you know what? Maybe I should start throwing this ramen up on Big Time Bites because that's the only food review site that I acknowledge here.
Is
on
it
the
actually?
Podcast.
Have you looked at it at all?
I've looked at it occasionally.
Do they review ramen on there?
There might have been one or
Why
two.
Why do they review things in basketballs?
Because Rich Cho was a former NBA
GM.
Okay,
how often do you think about the profession of the owner of a website when you're on that website? Like, you're just there to learn about food, right?
If it's the Pelton cast, hopefully a lot.
I guess so. Anyway, no, more power to you, Rich Cho. You should review this on Big Time Bites.
I just will. Anything else on food this week?
You're going back to LA tomorrow?
As we release this podcast on Monday, yes, it will be tomorrow.
Question, do you live there?
It does seem like it. I will have spent almost half of the January so far in Los Angeles by the end of this trip, which is weird.
Are you going to be trying any LA ramen while you're down there?
It's a possible consideration. I don't know if I want to do it during the midst of this bracket necessarily, though.
The most fun parts about doing searches and best ofs are kind of the extracurricular comments that you have, right? Like, LA Ramen might not be a competitor for Seattle's Best Ramen, but I'm curious how it rates.
Yes.
So if you go to what is considered the best ramen in LA...
I mean, I don't know if there is... First off, if there is...
Just queue up the TripAdvisor. Yeah. Find the one that has three or more reviews.
If there is a best ramen in LA, I'm assuming it's quite a wait. Probably even longer than Betsu Tenjin. But it's warmer to wait outside. So that's got that going for it.
Which so you're telling me you're not willing to compete hard enough?
I'm not saying that. First off, there's lots of other great food.
You're either competing or you're not.
I suppose that's a...
And
I
you're
can't
either competing
that.
Or you're not when it comes to the best ramen in LA. And I want to know how the best fucking ramen in LA compares to the number one seed ramen
then
in
why
Seattle.
Didn't you go have some ramen when you were so upset about burgers last week?
Oh, actually, that is one more thing that I have to do.
I think an apology is in order. A retraction. An official Pelton Cast retraction.
For one of the first times ever. We still need to get you to drink a sour beer, by the way. Your face is not bitter enough.
I'm not ducking it here. You need to go get one. I'm not buying my own sour beer, for God's sakes.
I feel like I need to retract the comments that I made last week about both Shake Shack and In-N-Out.
Thank you.
When I ate those foods, I may have been in the midst of a fairly epic hangover. I may not have gotten out of bed until approximately 5 o'clock. I guess a little bit earlier.
It was earlier than that.
But I definitely didn't get out of bed until 4 o'clock.
Okay.
And even then, I kind of felt like I was going to puke until like 4:30.
So not really the best condition to judge burgers in.
And even after that, my taste buds were just, they were all screwed up, right? For the entire day. Anything that I...
You did ask last week whether your taste buds could still be screwed up from going to Major Domo. That it just ruined everything else.
I asked you that yesterday. Well, I said, did Major Domo destroy my taste buds forever?
Which I mean, I can't tell you whether it did or not.
I don't think they did because Dombo was still great.
Okay. That's good to know.
But my feelings about both Shake Shack and In-N-Out needed to be regressed to the mean.
Yes. Yes, they did.
It was one bad experience, but it wasn't because of those locations. It came from within.
I'm glad that you can acknowledge this. That's very mature of you.
So we were still maybe a little bit too close to it. I had to think about it for a second. And I'd like to formally apologize to you, the listener, for my takes about those burger places. I will go to them when I'm in a better mindset, better heart next time.
The only lingering question is, when are you going to apologize to the listener for all your other food takes?
Oh, my.
Should we get to sports?
I almost called him James Don Bo Brooke.
That could be a nickname for him.
I would have had to apologize for that, too.
Okay. We left you last week with an update on Edgar Martinez's Hall of Fame candidacy, hashtag Edgar HOF, and we are now but one day away as we release this podcast from finding out whether Edgar Martinez will be a Hall of Famer. Still looking good for him.
It's close, though.
It's not a slam dunk. The latest update from the Baseball Hall of Fame tracker.
To use a baseball term. Yes. In the parlance of Edgar Martinez. You could have said it's not a home run.
It's not a grand salami. Edgar is now up to 18 votes gained over last year when he fell 20 votes short of induction. That's with a little less than half the ballots revealed thus far. So
all he needs to do is on two of the ballots that we haven't seen.
That he wasn't on last year.
Or he needs to maintain all of the previous ballots, plus two gain votes on two of the ballots that we haven't seen.
Yes.
And then he's in.
Then he's a Hall of Famer. So I think it's very likely, but it is not certain. There is going to be some drama leading up to the election.
Will this be
like a Mariners closer trying to pitch the ninth inning and get three outs.
But is this right now, bottom of the 10th inning, game 5... It's a little nerve-wracking, but you're feeling good. Or is it like down 6-7 runs, game 4, Edgar's at the plate? Because that to me is a little bit more nerve-wracking.
And it's probably like game three of that series with Randy Johnson on the mound and the Mariners kind of comfortably cruising to victory, but still the Yankees within striking distance.
Wow.
And actually, we've gone through a lot of the 95 ALDS.
There's only three baseball games that we care about ever. You managed to reference every single baseball game that we care about ever.
I care about the game in that series that who's the backup catcher who hit the game?
Jim Leritz.
Yeah.
I hate him forever.
Bitter rival Jim Leritz. Anyways, good luck to Edgar. We will hopefully be discussing this time next week his induction into the Hall of Fame.
We'll be talking about notable Edgar moments, such as the moments we just talked about.
Winning the batting title. The time that he got injured playing a series in Vancouver, an exhibition series before the start of the season, and it ruined his entire 1993 season. Yeah, that happened.
That's the Griffey baseball year?
Yeah.
So he's batting Griffey baseball because of an exhibition series in Vancouver?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't really like BC Place, but BC Place was not cool on that one. Whew. The one time he played third base in 1995 in Anaheim.
You're spoiling the next week's podcast. 96.
Oh, okay, fine. I'll save that.
Save it for the pod. I want to hear a lot more about this BC Place game.
I mean, I don't really actually actively remember it. I'm just aware it's a thing that happened.
He's bad in Griffey baseball.
That is correct.
I mean, he's not bad, but he's nowhere near as good as he should
be. No, he's bad. His batting average is like .243 with like four home runs that year. It was a rough year for Edgar.
Because that BC Place game?
Yeah. And then
he
basically DH'd the rest of his career. And that's why he's on the borderline to make the Hall of Fame. Because of that one game.
But I'm telling you, if he hit .356 that year, right? Is that what he hit in the... Or is that A-Rod?
I believe that was... one of them hit .356. I think Edgar hit .343 the year he won the batting title.
Just bullshit .343 year. If he hit .343 that year with like whatever 30-some home runs, he would be a monster in Griffey baseball.
That is accurate.
Wow. All right.
Yes.
He would be a John Kruk-like figure.
Does Baby Fantasy Genius not know that Edgar is good because he only pays attention to Griffey baseball?
And who are we calling Baby Fantasy? There's a lot of Baby Fantasy Geniuses.
Baby is the oldest. Then Baby Year is the middle, and Babyist is the youngest.
Okay.
And then the other 5 to 10 have their own nickname. yes. Oh, Edgar hit .343 in 92 to win the batting title and .356 in 95 to win the batting title.
There we go. I had it right.
We were both correct. A-Rod hit .358 to win the batting title.
I was
going to
say, I thought there was a .356 and .358 in there. All right.
And then in 93, somewhat in between those two, .237, 4 home runs, 13 RBI.
We maybe need to talk to the programmers at Griffey Baseball, so.
Retroactively bump up his ratings. Okay, but we'll get back to Edgar next week. Update on the Seattle Sounders, who have revealed their new kit sponsor. It's a big year for new sponsorships in Seattle sports.
Xbox 360 is gone.
Xbox is out.
Wow.
And in is Seattle-based retailer Zulily.
Oh, man.
Who will be sponsoring the kits for both the Sounders and the Seattle Rain.
Really?
Both announced last Thursday.
Wow, they're going hard on kit sponsorship.
Yes. A retailer that traditionally has targeted mothers. So there you go. Maybe that's why you don't know them. One bit of news.
I know them. You think I don't know Zulily? Are you kidding me? How many children do you think I have?
One bit of news from that sponsorship unveiling. Chad Marshall, who was there helping show off the new jerseys, said that he's going to be ready to go for training camp after his November surgery to repair a torn meniscus suffered against the Timbers in the playoffs.
All right.
So that's good news.
He's going to be picking up like an artisanal elephant toy and a pair of Toms.
The Seattle Seahawks, with an addition to their roster last week, signing quarterback Paxton Lynch to a futures contract.
You couldn't even keep up on the on the Zulily conversation.
I mean, what am I going to add there?
There's nothing for animals on there.
You'll recall that Paxton Lynch was the number 26 overall pick in the 2016 draft, with a pick acquired from the Seahawks.
Out of?
Memphis?
Maybe it was Memphis. I think that's right.
By the Denver Broncos.
Northern Illinois, but I think you're right that it was Memphis.
It was Eastern Illinois because all quarterbacks come from there. He was not very effective during his two seasons. It was Memphis with Denver having posting QBRs of 24.1 and 25.7 on 83 and 45 attempts respectively. He completed 62% of his passes, but for just 6.2 yards per attempt, and was sacked on a full 12% of his dropbacks during his time in Denver before being released at the end of 2018 training camp. Now, here's the bad news. So I've argued in the past that I think backup quarterbacks who are forced to play are underrated because everyone's like, look, they did so terrible. And then Alex Magoo doesn't have to play real defenses. He gets to play in the fourth quarter against the Raiders in the fourth preseason game.
Be cool. Okay.
But in preseason, Paxton Lynch has only averaged 5.7 yards per attempt.
He probably was playing stronger competition in preseason.
In what sense?
He was probably playing earlier in these games.
I suppose that's true, but that's still bad. Like, that's not good. That's still worst quarterback in the league territory. He has a lower yards per attempt in the preseason than in the regular season.
Was Paxton Lynch good in college?
So, I looked at the Football Outsiders projections for him. They were mediocre. They weren't awful, but they definitely weren't good either. So, I don't really think there's any reason to think that Paxton Lynch is a good prospect besides for the fact that he's tall.
Oh, God. Yeah, maybe John Elway is not that great at recognizing quarterback prospects.
Really loves a tall quarterback, though.
Hot take here.
Him and Brock Osweiler.
This is just a futures contract, basically, right? It's like a minimum level contract.
That is correct.
Who cares? Like, this is my take for this. If you sign somebody, like, granted, Paxton Lynch, I almost called him James Paxton like 4 or 5 times.
he's taller than James Paxton.
Really? He's taller than James Paxton?
I think so. He's 6'7".
He's pretty
James Paxton's like 6'5", right?
Paxton Lynch is probably not a good quarterback. We've talked about
almost,
this.
Let's go with almost certainly not a good quarterback.
At length, that finding a good second or third string quarterback for Russell Wilson really doesn't matter. But also, why not take the risk here? Like, I mean, he still has some sort of level of pedigree. Like, probably more so than Alex Magoo had. Which, whatever, you're signing him to a futures contract. Who cares?
I'm still hoping the Seahawks re-sign Brett Hundley.
Sure, re-sign Brett Hundley.
Which is weird to me that people are like ruling out that possibility just because he's an unrestricted free agent. Like, obviously the Seahawks liked him more than anyone else. That's why they traded a draft pick to go get it.
I don't know if that's exactly true, but...
What? I mean, he was available. Like, clearly the Packers would have shopped him around to other teams.
More than anyone else, though. What pick did they trade for him?
Like a 6th-rounder.
Maybe a team was offering a 7th-rounder.
I suppose, but that's still not as much. Math.
I don't know. I suppose I hear what you're saying. They didn't go to every single team, I guess is what I'm saying, and say, what will you offer for Brett Hundley? What will you offer for Brett Hundley? What will you offer for Brett Hundley? Like, to make a trade, just because a team makes a trade for a player doesn't mean that that team values X player more than any other team. That's a strange way to look at it.
I feel like they probably did talk to every team about it. It's not that hard. There's only 31 of them.
Still, they're just like...
It's not like it's college sports.
They're
working
that hard on
teams.
Shopping Brett Hundley?
Yeah, I mean...
Irrelevant to the Brett Hundley talk, which who cares? But signing this Paxton... I feel like people are a little bit too down on this Paxton Lynch signing.
I mean, you know, people need to have really strong opinions during the offseason because there's not that much going on.
Okay, so I told you that a year ago... The Seahawks went out and made a future signing. We might act like these future signings don't matter. And they went out and made a future signing for somebody who is going to be playing in the Pro Bowl next week.
And then somebody's Jason Myers.
Not playing for the Seahawks.
He is not, no. I mean,
and you have Jason Myers takes, which you wouldn't even tell me. You made me wait for these Jason Myers takes.
The take is that Jason Myers proves that kicking is completely random. Like, there was no evidence in Jason Myers' track record to suggest that all of a sudden he was going to emerge as the league's best kicker. He went from making 79% of his kicks in 2016.
Is he the league's best kicker?
73% in 2017 to making 92% this year.
Nice.
So, like, don't pay attention to past field goal percentages when you're evaluating kickers. It's all random.
What do you pay attention to?
Kickoffs. Where he actually was pretty good this year. The Jets, I believe, were 5th in terms of expected points added on kickoffs, and the Seahawks were substantially negative in that regard, although I got to be honest with you, I think the Michael Dixon kickoffs were probably a big part of that.
They were bad?
Yeah, there was a lot of kicks off out of bounds.
There were a lot?
A lot.
I think there was only one.
Yeah, I think there were at least two, and he didn't kick off that many times. The Seahawks were 30th in points EPA on kickoffs.
So they were one of the worst teams.
That would make them one of the 3 worst, yes.
And Jason Myers was one of the best.
One of the five. He was number five, yeah. Not great. Not great. My other takeaway is maybe don't have a kicker in their 40s unless it's Adam Vinatieri, but... And maybe not even then. Yeah.
This also recently... Do you want to talk about... So I think today on Sunday, as these championship games were happening, is the five-year anniversary of the tip game, which sent the Seahawks to the Super Bowl, their second ever Super Bowl, right?
Yes.
And then on Friday, last Friday, was the four-year anniversary of the comeback against the Packers.
Yeah.
Should we talk about those games now or wait?
I guess, I mean, I don't know that I have a ton of new thoughts on them. But I thought it was interesting that it occurred to me based on that, that we are, as of 2 weeks from now, out of the five-year grace period from the Seahawks winning.
Finally can fire Pete Carroll.
Hey, by the way, congrats to Daryl Bevel on getting a new gig.
Who's he? He's the Falcons offensive coordinator?
The Lions.
Oh.
I mean, the Falcons would have been a lot better job. That would have been a great job. Regression for the mean is going to work for you if you're the Falcons offensive coordinator. I don't know who they ended up hiring, but it wasn't him.
Did they chatted with him, right?
They did. A few teams did. But finally, the Lions pulled the trigger on Bevel.
For me, I mean, we've probably talked so much about the 49ers game. But the game the next year, right? It felt like going into that season, the Seahawks, as reigning champions, a lot of players were gone that season, right? Which is kind of what happens when you win a championship. Players are gone. Coaches are gone. The team looks just ever so different, a little bit weaker, but still have an excellent season. And you wonder if the urgency is going to be there, especially for the fan base, right? And if you can care as much. But somehow, in that game, I feel like I had seen the darkest place I've ever seen as a fan.
Well, the idea of potentially getting blown out at home in a conference championship game. I mean, the Seahawks haven't been there at a Seahawks playoff game that they've lost, correct?
I mean, when was the last time they lost a playoff game at home?
The Rams in 2004.
No, I've not. I've never been to a losing playoff game.
Yeah. And to not just lose, but it looked at that point like they were just going to get wiped off the field by the Packers.
It was different, though. Losing that game in 2004 was like, this is an upstart team playing in the wild card round.
It was also like, this is just a bad team.
The game against the Packers... Like, thinking about the Packers celebrating going to the Super Bowl on our home field, like, there was no less urgency that existed because the team had won the Super Bowl, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's sort of like the cliche about it. It's like, you don't care as much. I cared the most of anything. And during that game, the second and third and getting deeper into the fourth quarter, it was just like losing hope, losing hope, losing hope. It was a gross day. Russell Wilson was playing terrible. He'd been touched by rain.
Wasn't that gross?
It was a horrible day outside.
Huh.
It was like a classic Seattle January day. It was cold and gloomy, right? And they were playing the early game that year, whereas the previous, you mentioned that they go back and forth every year in the championship game. So they played the late game against the Niners the previous year. This was, like, the energy was so completely different.
Uh-huh.
There was kind of like a confidence going into that Niners game and like a swagger about that Seahawks team that they didn't really have the next year. They knew that they were a good team, and like we knew that they were a good team, but it wasn't the same sort of feeling going into it. Like, you could see that there was a chance they were going to lose. It was like destiny was on the previous year's side. And then just feeling the comeback moment by moment by moment and kind of seeing that swing, I think I've celebrated probably more than I've ever celebrated a football game. Like, the elation that you feel. We've talked about seeing the darkness. There was no level of darkness that I've ever seen worse. I remember just like sitting in my chair with my head in my hands facing the ground.
At a game. I mean... We saw a greater level of darkness a couple weeks after.
I don't think we did. I didn't feel the same way. There's a difference to being there and having to see the team celebrate on your home field.
Yeah,
like,
I guess that's fair.
I'm like in a comfortable house when we're watching that Patriots Super Bowl. Like, it was devastating, but it wasn't the same.
You did have to drive back to your home with baby or fantasy genius crying the entire way. I mean,
but it just, it wasn't like, I'd never been so depressed than I was deep into the fourth quarter of that championship game. And seeing that comeback is just like when you feel it as a sports fan, there's like this relief that you feel, right? It's like this giant weight is lifted off your chest. Sometimes you see it in NBA games, probably more so, like when a team is just playing sluggish and then all of a sudden they get on a roll and you're like, yes! Like, there's like something physically comes out of you where you're like, finally! I've been waiting for this. And that's what happened in that game, having something to celebrate. Seeing Marshawn walk into the end zone backwards, like, there was a feeling that we felt in that moment that we didn't even realize was possible in that darkest time before then.
I did not remember that play at all, of all those like key plays late in the game when I was watching through the highlights. That one I had no memory of.
It's someone that's kind of lost in the mix. Like, the John Ryan touchdown is obviously pretty prominent.
And then the two-point conversion kind of overshadows it. But, God. I mean, the thing about that game is it probably would not be possible to have that outcome now.
Because the onside kick rule?
Yeah. Because you just can't recover onside kicks anymore.
I don't know. I mean, it took...
I mean, not that it was likely before.
A Packers, muffed attempt.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't likely then, but it's even less likely now.
What was that dude's name? Chris Matthews?
Chris Matthews is the one who recovered it,
Recovered it and then had the monster game in the Super Bowl?
Yeah, and then we spent an entire offseason hyping Chris Matthews. And then he turned out to be the Brandon Marshall of his day.
Brandon Marshall. He's like the David Moore of that team.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing about that, you wonder in hindsight, would the Seahawks have been better off just losing that game and not having the play that ended up happening 2 weeks later?
I saw you talking about that, which I just don't agree with.
I mean, people probably were going to try to find a way to blame Russell Wilson in the offense no matter what if that team had lost a game, but... And when I say people, I mean Richard Sherman. But the level
haters
of
the building.
Look, he's great, but Sherman never got over the Super Bowl, and it was a real problem. Like,
I don't know.
You don't know?
The same thing would have happened with all of the teams. Richard Sherman is not that big of a deal. Right? If you want to go season by season, the next year Russ had an epically good season. Just put it together, like, he turned it on a little bit too late so they couldn't get home field and win the Super Bowl, or at least go to the Super Bowl. The following year, he was hurt. The next year was the Tom Cable horrible offensive line year. Then you get to the season. Like, which of these years is the Richard Sherman affected the team year? I'm sorry, but there's one thing that matters to the Seahawks, and that one thing is A, how much they pass the ball, and B, how much they let Russell Wilson pass the ball. Like, the defense matters about this much.
I don't agree with
that. The run game matters even less. And the only thing that matters to the Seahawks' success is Russell Wilson.
Yeah, but how they evaluate Russell Wilson probably depends in part on the success they have.
Did they? I don't believe that.
Or how they evaluate the efficacy of needing to go back to the basics.
I don't agree with that, though. You're talking about...
You don't reevaluate things when you win.
Pete Carroll
doesn't, like, look, Pete Carroll may have a process-based
philosophy. He's
going to
change his philosophy after 72 years because of Richard Sherman. But, like, just chill with this perspective. Pete Carroll is who he was before he got here, and he will be who he is after he's gone.
But his
we can now fire him.
Recommitted,
it's been 5 years.
He recommitted to his philosophy last offseason. Do you not agree with that? Do you not think there was a recommitment?
I think there was a
that
recommitment
wouldn't have
because
happened
the record was bad. I don't think there was a recommitment.
That's what I'm saying.
There was.
If you had won two Super Bowls, there might not be a need to recommit to anything.
No. One play does not change that.
One play has a lot of meaning.
Missing the
you
playoffs.
You under restraint. But let's talk about...
Is why he recommitted.
Let's talk about the real thing here.
All right.
Which is the common denominator in those two championship games. The greatest hero in Seahawks history.
Yes.
And that man's name is Jermaine Damn Curse.
Yes. I mean, all Jermaine Curse does is make big plays. He actually won them the second Super Bowl. We don't remember that. Huge play.
Really made up with that touchdown against Green Bay for, like, the first six passes targeted for him. I think, like, four of them were intercepted. None of them were catches.
They were all Russ's fault.
It was not his fault, but it was a funny game.
It was a rough game for Russ. Like, miss Jermaine Kearse.
Unrestricted free agent Jermaine Kearse.
Oh, hello.
And you know what?
Future Seahawks Jermaine
You know
Kearse.
What? It's an odd year that Mr. Jermaine Kearse is actually going to be good this year.
You want to talk about valuing somebody more than anybody else values them.
Oh, the Pelton cast.
The Pelton no, cast the is going to sign Jermaine Kearse. The Seahawks can offer Jermaine Kearse the league minimum plus $1.
Well.
No, I don't. I'm curious to see what he gets this offseason.
Bring him back. Bring him back.
I mean, could this team have not used a Jermaine Kearse this year? If you imagine it's Doug Baldwin, Jermaine Kearse, and Tyler Lockett out there, like that's a pretty good wide receiving core. They might be able to win you one Super Bowl and take you to the brink of winning a second.
I think they'll probably be looking for a bigger receiver in that role, but I'm still going to hold out hope for Jermaine Kearse.
Maybe like a veteran receiver who can't catch the ball?
Yes. They might draft someone. I would not be surprised if they drafted a receiver this year.
Draft a kicker.
I'm all for it. UW women's basketball lost 91-54 on Friday at number 6 Stanford. Much more competitive on Sunday at Cal, losing by single digits in that one. The schedule will not get any easier for the 1-6 Huskies in Pac-12 play. Next weekend is they return home to host a pair of top 10 teams, number 10 Oregon State and number 5 Oregon.
Pac-12 women's basketball is like bizarro Pac-12 men's basketball.
Yeah, that's true. That is very true. They have a number of three top 10. The Huskies will have played three top 10 teams in a 2-week span here. I do encourage everyone to get out next Sunday to Heck-Ed and check out Oregon and Sabrina Ionescu.
Ooh, I have plans watching the Pro Bowl.
DVR the Pro Bowl. Come out and watch Sabrina Ionescu. She's the best player in college basketball, men's or women. No, actually, I guess Zion is probably better than her.
Men's or women's. Wow. The takes are hot.
I don't know.
Zion's going to be like a generational level basketball
player. She's got a lot more triple doubles than Zion. She's more experienced.
We've learned that triple doubles don't matter.
They're not the most important.
Where do you think Zion ranks for you as far as prospects? Have you done this?
We're saving that for a forthcoming story.
Is it really good?
It's pretty good. It's not bad.
Is he better than Anthony Davis?
We'll see.
Isn't Anthony Davis like one of the best prospects you've ever judged?
Yes.
It's close.
It's in the ballpark.
All right. Well, go check out this person for Oregon on Sunday. Wait, what is her name?
Sabrina Ionescu, she has a chance to, she's eligible if she chooses to enter the WNBA draft and be the number one pick by Las Vegas.
As a junior?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Which would kind of, it would be bad news for Kelsey Plum.
Is she a guard also?
She is.
They're pretty guard heavy, right? What's the other person?
Yeah, they do. Yeah,
the other
are.
Person they drafted?
They have Kaylin McBride is one of their better players.
I thought they had another.
Asia Wilson, they drafted Asia number Wilson. One last year, but she's a power forward center.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So she's a different player. Vegas is going to be really good in a couple of years here.
Man, this summer.
Some Vegas storm battles.
We're
going to
be there.
Up.
Mandalay Bay, back-to-back live in Vegas.
Are we breaking news there?
We'll see.
Okay. All right, we wrap up with UW men's basketball. Now, the best team in the Pac-12 at 5-0.
There we go.
After beating Stanford 780-64 on Thursday and Cal 71-52 on Saturday. It's a 7-game winning streak for the Huskies, who last lost on December 15th. They've gone 5 weeks and counting without a loss.
All they needed was to play really bad teams.
Yeah, the easiest Pac-12 schedule by far so far. They have already played the four lowest rated Pac-12 teams by KenPom thus far. It gets a little more difficult this weekend as they travel to the Oregon schools, playing at Oregon on Thursday and at Oregon State on Saturday. A couple of things I wanted to discuss before we look at next week. I think one of the interesting things has been the Huskies' transformation into a team that was really built around Noah Dickerson's post skills. Michael Dickerson would be amazing at this point. Noah Dickerson's post skills to Jalen Noel on the perimeter. Last year, if you looked at the usage rate of those two players in conference play, it was basically even. Noel 28%, Dickerson 27%. This year, Noel is still at 27%, which is sixth highest in the Pac-12. Dickerson's usage rate is down to 21% of the Huskies' plays, and he was really largely a non-factor. I mean, he did draw a lot of fouls against Cal, but largely a non-factor in these two games this past weekend.
Why do you think that is?
I mean, it's It's weird because it's the same perimeter group, but it doesn't feel like they have a lot of players set up to maximize Noah Dickerson. Like, they don't pass well. They don't get any assists. They don't necessarily, even though they're still number one in 3-point percentage in Pac-12 play, and their opponents now are, by the way, are shooting, did I lose this? Oh, 27% now from 3-point range this season.
You're going to tell me this isn't real?
Including a combined 4 of 30 3-point shooting by Stanford and Cal last weekend.
You think
weekend.
This is all luck?
It's not all luck.
There is a factor here of 3-point defense.
They're doing a good job of cutting down on attempts. Something that someone tweeted us last week is that the 2-3 was extended so far. I think this was during the Utah game, maybe Colorado, that it almost looks like a 4-1 defense. Like just the center in the middle, and then all of the other players are basically extended up to the top when the opponent first comes into the offensive
trying to limit those 3-point attempts.
Yeah, and then when a pass comes basically below the free throw line, then those two wing players will fill back and make it in a more traditional 2-3. But it's definitely like extending out to take away the three, and so that's a good thing. But teams aren't always going to shoot 1 of 15 from three.
It felt like, to me, for kind of Dickerson and usage, right, that the team in the past really tried to force it into the post.
Yes.
Even so much that maybe they'd seen early in the year that it was kind of like bogging down their offense a little bit.
Sometimes.
So they were working so hard to get the ball in the post that players weren't moving. They weren't moving the ball. And now the offense just feels that much more natural.
I don't know, to some extent. They still don't have a lot of ball movement. It's still a lot of isolation play from Noel.
But it feels a little bit more like everybody's getting involved, right? I mean, they've added...
And that is, yeah, that is one of the differences. It's not like Noel is actually using any more plays than last year. It's just that those have been redistributed amongst other guys. Naz Carter probably picked up.
That's what I was
going to
say, is adding Naz Carter as a threat on offense, I think, it is the thing that changes it. I mean... The players that you would have expected, like, say, Thibault or somebody like that, have not really stepped it up offensively.
No.
And also, how efficient is Noel being on that 27% of plays?
Still not that efficient. And Dickerson has actually been almost exactly as efficient as last year. So it's not like necessarily the Huskies are going away from him because he's been less effective.
I don't think this is a Dickerson issue, though. I think it's that they want to keep the ball moving just a little bit more, spend a little bit less time dribbling it down, forcing it into Dickerson in the post. They want to work to get, you know, move the ball around to get Dominic Green open threes and stuff like that.
I mean, something I'd say is I think Dickerson's going to have his games. There are going to be points during the Pac-12 season where you're just going to ride him. Like, we've seen that before and we'll see it again. But maybe just not as frequently as last year.
Okay, I asked you this last week. I'm going to ask you it again. Polls come out tomorrow?
As we record this on Sunday night, yes.
Chances that the Huskies are ranked?
Very low. I would say 5% at best. I think, though, that they will be near the top of the other teams receiving votes.
Okay.
So, if they were to sweep this weekend against the Oregon schools, I think then they would crack the top 25.
Chances that if the NCAA tournament selection show happened today, they would be in as an at-large bid.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they'll probably be in 8 or 9 in the next bracketology.
Okay. So the Pac-12 looks like a two-team conference right now.
I mean, it depends what happens with the other teams. But I think that the Huskies, like, if it were today, if they lost, like, at least in the semifinals of the Pac-12 tournament, that they would be in, would be my take.
Okay.
But there's still a long ways to go. All right. A lot more difficult.
5-0 is a great place to be.
It's the best start for the Huskies in conference play since, was it 1984? It was a very long time ago that they started 5-0 in conference play.
I remember them being 5-0 not that long ago.
Well, you remember incorrectly then, apparently, because it definitely didn't happen. Yeah, first time since 1984.
Wow. All right.
Detlef Schrempf is not walking through that door.
Okay. James Edwards, Detlef.
Oh, the other thing we didn't say, by the way, the 1,000th all-time win for the Huskies at Heck Edmondson Pavilion, becoming the first program in NCAA history to win 1,000 games.
Really?
In their arena. And so this is largely a product of the fact that the Huskies have been playing at Heckhead since, I believe, 1927. So they've had a lot of opportunities to win games there.
I mean, 1,000 games is a lot, considering that schedule.
It is a lot of games. There are a few teams who have
like,
played.
What about Duke? Have they changed arenas that recently?
Duke's Cameron opened, I believe, in 1940.
It's relatively recently.
Or maybe sometime in the 40s, because it definitely, that's one of the, clearly one of the highest, but it is obviously not as high as Heckhead.
So this is the most of any team ever?
That's what they're saying.
Wow.
So there are two teams that have played in their current gym longer than the Huskies, Northeastern and Fordham.
All right.
Fordham, 1925, Northeastern opened in 1910. They just haven't had as many wins, apparently. Let's see here.
Is it that rare? To me, this seems totally normal.
Yeah, Cameron,
normal.
In fact, is 1940.
This seems totally normal to me to be playing in the same arena for that long.
It's pretty rare. I mean, there's a lot that are not that much newer, but Haas Pavilion for Cal, for example, is 1933. It's 6 years fewer, and they haven't been as good.
So how many total wins is Duke at? Can you see that?
I don't know when this was updated on Wikipedia, but they were at that point 832.
Wow. By this measurement, which is the only important measurement to college basketball success, the Huskies are the best college basketball program in the country.
That is correct. I've always said it.
Okay, so this week, Oregon on Thursday.
Yeah, Oregon has been perhaps Pac-12's biggest disappointment, dropping to 2-3 with Saturday's 14-point loss at Arizona State. They come in ranked 52nd.
14-point home loss at Arizona State, you're at.
I didn't remove the home, and I updated that one. They come in ranked number 52 in KenPom, about 7 spots behind the Huskies.
And they were ahead of the Huskies as of, I think, yesterday.
Really?
I looked it up yesterday, yes.
Okay, well,
they fell pretty significantly.
They dropped a lot with that Arizona State loss because they're now third in the Pac-12 behind UW and Arizona. They did hand the Wildcats their only loss of conference play thus far last weekend. This is a team that started out.
And that was in Tempe, or?
That was in Tucson. Okay. Which is where Arizona is.
That was in Flagstaff.
It was in Phoenix. Nobody
could protect Mesa, Arizona.
They came into the season ranked and were probably the favorites in the Pac-12. Started out with a split versus Iowa and Syracuse at the 2K Sports Classic before getting shocked at home by Texas Southern and losing at Houston to a team that has been ranked. Future NBA lottery pick Bol Bol suffered a non-displaced navicular fracture after 9 games and underwent season-ending surgery, subsequently declaring for the NBA draft and ending his brief time at Oregon. The Ducks also played their first 3 conference games without sophomore center Kenny Wooten, who dominated the Huskies last year with 11 blocks in 2 games against UW. He had a jaw fracture and then came back last weekend for the 2 Arizona games. Had only 1 block in those 2 games combined, so was not nearly as effective. Their other All-American freshman, McDonald's All-American freshman Lewis King, who missed the start of the season due to injury, has really taken over a leading role in conference play, using 27% of their plays, putting him in the top 5 of Pac-12 players. He's shooting 39% on threes, but just 43% on twos so far in Pac-12 play. Oregon overall ranks 11th among Pac-12 teams in effective field goal percentage in conference play, last in free throw rate. They are notably forcing the most turnovers of any Pac-12 teams. That'll be something for the Huskies to avoid.
How much of their lack of success this year has to do with the Bol Bol injury?
I mean, they would obviously be a much better team with Bol Bol. He was in the lineup for that Texas Southern loss. They were 6-3 with him. So they weren't like playing great, but they have been much worse than expected since
his tenure at Oregon is like Kyrie-like tenure, sub-Kyrie-like tenure.
Yeah, and Kyrie at least came back for the NCAA tournament. It really doesn't always work out that great having a top prospect, but hopefully it'll work out well, because we'll get to that in a second.
It'll work for us, but maybe it'll work for us.
It worked out so well with Markelle Fultz and Michael Porter.
Teams trick themselves into thinking that it'll work for them. Do you have a percentage chance of victory in this game specifically?
So Oregon is still favored, I think, but you know, maybe like 45%.
Very winnable game.
Yeah. And if they win this one, they're looking really good at that point.
Really?
Although Oregon State on Saturday could be tricky. They started 3-0 in conference play, including a win at Oregon, but then lost both games on the Arizona trip last weekend.
Which is probably still the hardest trip in the Pac-12.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think it probably is, yeah. A couple of bad non-conference losses for the Beavers. They lost to Texas A&M at the Motive Center, who the Huskies beat in Vancouver, and then also at home versus Kent State. So they come in ranked 68th in KenPom. Pretty much average at both ends during conference play, although they're getting to it in an interesting way. They allow the lowest two-point percentage among Pac-12 teams in conference play. And if you look at the entire season, it's the fourth lowest in the country, but rarely force turnovers and give up offensive rebounds. So they struggle with opponents get a lot more shots than they do. The reason they've been so effective defensively is 7-foot JC transfer Kyler Kelly, native of small town Oregon, who has replaced Drew Eubanks, who's on a two-way contract with the San Antonio Spurs at center, and leads the NCAA in block shot rates. He's also a high percentage finisher, making 63% of his twos. So the Huskies will want to try to keep him from getting easy opportunities at the rim. Stephen Thompson, the good news here, by the way, is this is Stephen Thompson's last chance to beat the Huskies with a game-winning three at Reser, or not Reser, Reser is the football stadium.
Let's stick with Reser.
Okay.
It's been open since 1910.
Gil Coliseum is where the Oregon State plays.
Tinkle Arena.
Thompson's having a disappointing season. He's shooting just 31% on threes. His two-point percentage is also way down as he's come back for his senior year. But Trace Tinkle has been great, the son of Wayne Tinkle, of course, the Oregon State coach. The current leader for Pac-12 KenPom KPOY, KenPom Player of the Year.
This should be KPPOY.
You'll have to take that up with him. Jalen Noel is second in that.
He's not going to award it for the Pac-12 this year.
Hmm?
He's not going to award it for the Pac-12 this year.
No, not awarded this year.
I'm not going to take anything up with Ken Pomeroy about the Pac-12.
Tinkle has been great.
He doesn't want to talk to me about it.
He's making 60% of his twos and leads the team in assist rate. So he has been very effective against the Huskies.
How is
playing
Stephen
kind of
Thompson
the middle of the
still
zone.
Playing?
I mean, it's a senior.
Get this man out of the Pac-12. Nobody wants him there.
Maybe
the Blazers broadcast could use an extra player or an extra person on that team. Just get Stephen Thompson off the court against the Huskies.
So you're saying that him and Lamar Hurd, they need to have the Beaver connection?
Yeah.
So this game is, by, you know, on paper, the more winnable game. But Oregon State is scary.
They're going to win. God, we have no chance in this freaking game. Right?
We have a chance. It's going to be close.
Yeah. I mean, they'll either hit a three to win in regulation or hit a three to win in overtime.
Yeah.
We know 50-50. How this goes. We've seen this game before.
Too many times.
Maybe this is a different year. That's the thing that I keep holding out blind optimism and hope, is that maybe Mike Hopkins with this team has figured out some sort of magic
to keep teams from ever hitting threes.
Kind of seems like it so far. To be able to, they went and they played pretty excellent on a road trip against kind of the mountain schools. They've more or less dominated their home games, right?
Yeah.
They kind of arm's lengthed both Stanford and Cal.
After trailing by double digits to Cal in the first half, yes.
But in the end, it ended up where it needed to be.
Yes. Yes, it did.
Maybe against Oregon and Oregon State, they can go into the half tied and kind of do this Husky 2018-19 season thing where they turn it on in the second half and somehow pull out like a 10-point victory in both of these games.
Here's the thing, though. No matter what happens this road trip, the Huskies' biggest win of the week has already happened.
Really?
Because they got a commitment on Sunday.
No, I'm making the NCAA tournament. If they could win, yes, the biggest win of the week. If they could win these games and position themselves at 7-0 in the Pac-12, in a very good place to go to the NCAA tournament, making that tournament would be more important than any sort of recruiting win.
Biggest win of the week. Getting a commitment from the number 5 overall recruit in ESPN's rankings, Isaiah Stewart.
The biggest recruit to UW in the last 2 weeks.
A 6'9" big man from Rochester, New York, who chose UW over Duke, Kentucky, Michigan State, and Syracuse eat it, Duke, Kentucky, Michigan, St. Syracuse.
That's the
he's nothing.
The long lost Stewart brother that we were waiting to recruit.
I think he's going to be the best of the Stewart brothers too. I like his chances. Played summer ball with both Naz Carter and Hamir Wright, who are also from upstate New York. Or played, I guess. No, they're not. They're not from upstate New York.
Naz Let's is. Just keep Mike Hopkins summering in upstate New York.
Hopkins had been recruiting him at Syracuse, had kind of been like the first assistant coach who was in on him as a recruit, and that relationship really paid off for the Huskies.
I heard, you know, Albany is beautiful. In June, July, Ithaca. I just pronounced Ithaca the most ridiculous way. I hear Ithaca is very nice around that time of year. Even you stretch it into the fall when the leaves are changing. Maybe they summer in Montauk.
What about Buffalo?
Oh, Buffalo is gorgeous. Go see Joe Pera. Let's just make sure that Mike Hopkins keeps that connection alive.
The thing I like most about Stewart's recruiting is that he pledged to go help recruit Jaden McDaniels, the Federal Way star, who is also a five-star recruit.
Oh, the Federal Way star?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
He sounds like a long-lost cousin of Mrs. Fantasy Genius.
Yes.
Jaden McDaniels.
Yes. I mean, all of a sudden, like, we were kind of nervous about, like, what happens if the Huskies don't make the NCAA tournament this year. Not only do they now appear better positioned to make the NCAA tournament this year.
I think the Quad A Green signing, I think, kind of changes things.
Yeah, I mean, now, if Jalen Noel comes back, you'd be looking probably at a starting lineup of Quad A Green once he becomes eligible at the semester break or the quarter break. Noel, Naz Carter, Wright, Hamir Wright, and Isaiah Stewart. And that's a pretty strong lineup before you even consider the possibility that Jaden McDaniels does in fact choose UW.
Quickly tell us about Isaiah Stewart and his game.
A long wingspan, just considered kind of a strong all-around big man.
Can he shoot?
I don't know that much.
Okay. Like, you're not like a basketball analyst or anything.
I haven't paid that much attention to it, even though, like, we've known that it was a possibility until...
See if he can tell us about Isaiah Stewart.
I don't think he follows recruiting that closely.
When is Caden McDaniels expected to make his choice?
Jaden McDaniels. I don't know. He probably won't until the spring.
Caden McDaniels?
You don't usually hear... This is kind of so he timed this decision. There's the Hoop Hall tournament that's going on this week, and that's where he announced this on ESPNU. But usually you don't see a lot of players announce until, if they're not going to sign in the early period in December, they don't usually announce until the spring. So this is kind of an unusual timing for him.
For Isaiah Stewart?
Yeah. So we probably won't hear about McDaniels for a while.
Interesting.
But I would expect... I think there's a pretty good chance that both of these guys end up playing in the Nike Hoop Summit in Portland this spring. So nice. I'll get a chance to see them there.
Anyway, ask him about the leaves changing in upstate New York.
I'm sure will.
Make that your first question.
The foliage is beautiful.
It is interesting, though, that pipeline from Mike Hopkins has kind of paid dividends so quickly. I mean, you talk about those players kind of coming through. And Naz Carter being kind of like the next generation of recruits that he picked up kind of near the end of his first offseason as Husky head coach, and then now going out and getting a top five player in the country from that pipeline is pretty huge. So if he can establish something sort of in the Northwest but kind of maintain those roots and that connection to the Northeast, it'll be really huge, especially when he's the coach of Syracuse in about 5 years.
I don't know how long this is going to last after he's outside the Northeast, because the real
thing is he's a good recruiter.
Yeah.
Like, but what he's saying matters.
But I think what you're seeing is these players that he had established rapport with, been in on early, that's paying off.
Yes.
And in the future years, that's going to be players in the Northwest who he's been in on early.
He's got
a little bit of New York
Romar in him.
Sure.
Is that not true?
I mean,
look, these people are recruiting very well, considering that UW hasn't been to an NCAA tournament and I don't even remember.
All right, this is true. I mean, the fact that this is the third top five recruit that the Huskies have signed in the last 5 years.
Are you counting Michael Porter?
I am counting Michael Porter.
R.I.P.
He's still alive. Very much alive. Alive in Denver, which was a TV show.
Is it really? Is that on CBS? Did I learn about that during the AFC Championship game?
No, it was on some streaming show, but it was by Michael Levin of Sixers Twitter fame. So.
Alive in Denver?
Yeah.
Starring Matt LeBlanc.
It's not starring Matt LeBlanc.
Oh my god.
All right, well, that's all the fake TV shows we're going to come up with this week.
Wait, is that not a real TV show?
No, I mean, it is a real TV show, but you came up with a fake version of it, I guess.
Okay.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.